excited. I'm like,
tell me when you're ready.
There's really a lot of concerns that I'm hoping you can go back and resolve them.
The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. Today is March 18th, 2014. We're waiting for more senators to arrive for a quorum, but in the meantime, we're going to start on the agenda because our House colleagues, many of them, have to leave to attend other committee meetings in an hour or so. Let's start with Senate File 2680, House File 1352, Senator Eakin, Senator Marquardt. Why don't you come up here, and we can start by Mr. Martin wants to give us a little description to begin with.
Members, in your packets, this is item number two. This is a This is a deadline extension for applying for a disability benefit from PERA Police and Fire. It relates to a Wadena County Sheriff's deputy who was involved in an altercation and now believes he is disabled. He has missed the 18-month window for which he could apply for PERA Police and Fire disability benefits. Since those ran out sometime in 2012, he's no longer eligible to apply for a PERA Police and Fire disability benefit. He does want to extend the time period in which he can file for the application. He can file an application for the benefits. The bill does not grant him the disability benefit. It simply permits him to make the case. With that, members, I would just soon turn it over to the authors and to the constituent.
Welcome, Representative Marquardt. If you want to introduce yourself to the committee, apologize, we don't have more senators here, and okay. You can talk a little bit about your bill or have your constituent or tell a story.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, for hearing this, and I appreciate Representative Morgan speaking to the bill about a month ago when you had this meeting, and I was still in the classroom teaching, so I appreciate you putting this back on the agenda when the constituent, Mr. Shaw, could also be here. Mr. Martin certainly laid out the facts of the case, and I would just like to add this before I turn it over to Mr. Shaw to kind of tell his story, is that he resigned from law enforcement in about October of 2010, and the 18-month extension went to April or May of 2012. He contacted me in June of 2012, like one month later, and I know this committee doesn't want to set new precedents and so forth, but I do think in looking through the information that Mr. Martin did provide, there is the 2002 case with a Blooming Prairie police officer who also had post-traumatic stress disorder that through his law enforcement career, and the fact of the matter is sometimes that takes longer to recognize than even an 18-month period may incur there. So I do think there's some merit here, certainly, in looking at extension and looking at Mr. Shaw's case and all this. And also I think it's important that we kind of look at the situation that's at hand, and that is a person who loves law enforcement really can't do that anymore. And we've talked about this. This has been a big part of his life, and he's unable to do that, kind of his livelihood here. And I think the fact that it was one month, that he came to me, and we could have acted quicker had it even been a couple months before that. So Madam Chair, I'd like to turn this over to Dave Shaw, the constituent here, if that would be all right with the Madam Chair and the committee.
Mr. Shaw, welcome. If you would just repeat your name, please, for the tape.
David Shaw. And I thank you, Madam Chair and Commission members, for hearing me today. As Mr. Marquardt spoke of, I've served for 10 and a half years in law enforcement. And previous 10 and a half years to that, I was a fireman. And at that time was about half of my life that I dedicated to answering calls of service. And I really, really enjoyed it, and I think I was good at it. The incident that happened in Wadena County was surprising to the fact that I never thought I would have to do that. I had an S on my chest that I could always talk an individual down. I would never have to use that level of force. And to my surprise, it happened that day. My hand was forced. Luckily, my bullet missed its mark, and the individual's walking and talking today, and I'm very happy to tell you that. However, it doesn't change the fact that it hit pretty close to home. I appeared after the shooting that I was no worse for wear. I was exonerated from the incident and relieved to go back to duty, and did so. It wasn't until a couple years later that I noticed some changes in how I was performing my job, starting seeing traits in myself that I despised in seeing others, and I really prided myself in how I dealt with people. You know, we deal with good people on a daily basis that just inadvertently make poor decisions, and that doesn't make them any less of a person. And that's how I went to work, and that's how I treated people. And the traits that I saw coming up in me that made me resign, I'd like to elaborate on that for a minute. I started treating good people like criminals. Simple traffic stops. I'd go on a traffic stop, my holster was unsnapped every time. Put my thumbprint on the trunk of the car, and just being escalated in a manner of fashion, my attitude where I was dealing with these people as hardened criminals, and there's no place for that. So that's the reason I took a step back. Retirement was not even in my thought. Because I was a good officer, I did my job well. And I just wanted to take a step back, remove myself from it, see if I could overcome my problems and go back to work. Personally, firemen and police officers, they're not the ones that ask for help. They're the ones that go out and help people on a daily basis. I was not prepared to ask for help. And when it starts affecting my wife and my kids, it was time to get help. I went to the doctor in Holly, Minnesota, and he said, yeah, it sounds like you have some PTSD issues and you need to get help. I want you to see a psychiatrist. I couldn't afford that bill out of my own pocket, so I went back to Wadena County and asked them for a workman's comp claim surrounding that issue. Their response was, well, Mr. Shaw, did you get hurt physically that day? I said, no, ma'am, I didn't. I said, well, we can't help you unless there was a physical injury. It's my take on this, whether I'm right or wrong, that sometimes mental injuries can be worse than a physical injury. I wish that I would have gotten hurt that day because I would have bounced back from it and gone on with my life and still been a good cop today. These mental things that I'm dealing with, I can't quite get a grasp on them. I can't afford to get the help that I need, which is why I decided that I had no other alternative but to apply for retirement. And that's when I found out that I'd missed the deadline, which leads me to here today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think we have Ms. Jones here from PERA. Did you have does PERA have a position on this?
Shana Jones, I'm on the staff at PERA, and I just have a few points about Mr. Shaw's account. And I think maybe I shared a few of these with you last time, but I'll make a couple of them again. As far as I can see from Mr. Shaw's account, he was a part-time police officer with all of his para-covered employers, meaning that without a resolution from the employing entity, he would have gone into our general plan, and the standard for a disability benefit would have been completely different. So just that's something that's unique to his situation versus a full-time officer who would automatically go into the police and fire plan.
I just want to say that a quorum is present. Thank you.
I also would like to make mention of the fact that Mr. Shaw did receive annual statements from PERA, which included information on the benefits that he was entitled to. That's a standard practice for all of our members, and that was the same for him. We don't have any record of contact with Mr. Shaw until October of 2013. You said you contacted your representative in 2012, but we only came to know of it in 2013. And he was correct. He did have 18 months from termination to apply. That would have put us back in March 21st of 2012.
Yes, he did.
And so, again, we didn't come have any contact until a year and a half later. The provisions that are drafted would only allow him to apply for a duty disability benefit. And then just to mention a couple points about the criteria we would use to determine eligibility for that, he would, number one, have to prove that he was disabled while he was employed in public service, so prior to 2010. And the farther out we get from that date, the more difficult it is to do that. Secondly, for a duty disability, we would have to be able to connect that injury or illness to something that was inherently dangerous in the profession. And so I believe that the incident that's referenced is back in 2006, and again, we're getting farther and farther away. We're 8 years from that, and it can be difficult to do something this far afterwards. The only other point that I have, again, is specific to his account. And again, as I understand it, in 2006 is when the onset of this occurred. Our records show that he, in fact, did take another police and fire position in 2009. So he ended that one and then did take another position and continued doing police work, again, albeit part-time, and otherwise it would have been general plan service, but still was in police work. That concludes my comments.
So what Mr. Shaw is asking us to do today is just allow him to file the disability application. It's not to approve a disability, early retirement, correct? That's what you're asking?
Yes, yeah. Madam Chair. That's correct.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions? Do we want to lay this over for more thought? Does somebody want to make a motion?
I'll make a motion.
All right, Senator Goodwin, what is your motion?
The motion is to pass this bill and include it in the pension.
Any other discussion about that?
Madam Chair, I just want to say a couple things about that. You know, if it's true that he only missed one deadline, and I think he is right about the approach that they would take in the department as far as him not having a physical disability and instead having an emotional or mental disability is unfair. And sometimes it takes quite a while for post-traumatic stress symptoms to appear. They don't automatically appear right after an incident or a year or two even, but sometimes it takes longer than that. So, and especially with mental health issues, they're more likely to come up later than earlier. And I'm just saying, I think we should give him a chance to apply. What's
make
the harm?
Make his case.
Yep. Make his case.
Senator Nelson, Representative Nelson.
Demoting me there. Madam Chair, I guess the question I have, I see there's an amendment, and which would set the date from 2014 to 2015, if I remember right reading it. It would give him a year as opposed to till June 30th of this year, I guess.
Yes.
What's the benefits of that, or one way or the other?
Members, this bill was introduced in 2013, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm just resetting the date. Yes, it was introduced in March of 2013, and so a 2014 deadline for a 2013 bill would have given him more than a few months, and so I'm just resetting the date so it adjusts for passage in 2014 rather than 2013. I need a motion for that amendment.
Representative Benson.
And Madam Chair, this commission isn't responsible for adjudicating a claim, and I can really fully appreciate that and the testimony that was given that's the process that really needs to hear this. Are we setting any precedent? I guess that would be the only question that I would have in terms of how we would extend or go about extending in terms of setting a baseline, so to speak, for making these determinations, or would they continue to come up one at a time with a thoughtful discussion and that kind of thing. That would be my only concern. I fully realize that. I'm glad we're not tasked with adjudicating that claim. You know, I think there's very complicated issues here. My only questioning along a line of, as a pension commission, in terms of setting policy, therefore, forth, you know, in terms of how we'd go about and extending the eligibility for someone to file for the claim.
Mr. Martin.
Members, if you turn to page 5 of the memo, this would be the bottom of attachment B, as in boy. There are five instances in the past when the commission has, I'm sorry, seven instances in the past when we have extended the time period. This is page 5.
And Mr. Martin, what did you mean by adherence to applicable commission policy principles? Are there principles that apply to this?
Yes, members. There, if you look on page 5 again, the policy principle on deadline extensions and waivers, this provides for case-by-case odd determination with an equitable basis without undue precedent.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Sam Benson. Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's what I was just trying to get some clarification of, is just in making sure that we're not doing something that was setting a precedent. And I'll take the answer from Mr. Martin that, indeed, that this will have no precedent in future cases. They'll be taken one by one.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I would like to move the 1A amendment that resets the date to 2015 to give the petitioner a little extra time to sort this through.
Okay, technically, Senator Goodwin's amendment is on the table, so maybe you could withdraw your motion.
Okay, Madam Chair, I withdraw my motion for now.
She had the motion to approve the bill.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Yes. So Representative Morgan moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Any more discussion? Then
my motion.
Senator Goodwin.
Then my motion is to pass this. I'm trying to think what the
2680, also 1352.
Pass 2680 as amended and include it in the omnibus pension bill.
Any more discussion? Anyone from the audience who wants to comment? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Chair members, thank you.
Good luck to you. Mr. Shaw. We're going to take the Senate File 2429, number 7 on the agenda. The State Auditor's Volunteer Fire Working Group recommendations next. The minutes?
Well, we got a quorum.
Yeah. Representative Nelson moves that we approve the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Auditor.
Yes.
Madam Auditor.
Madam Chair and members of the Pension Commission, the Senate File.
Otto.
2429 is the Office of the State Auditor's annual Volunteer Fire Relief Association Working Group bill. The working group, just to give you a really quick brief background, is made up of Relief Association trustees from both the Metro and Greater Minnesota and of the different each service pension plan type, plus it includes service fire service organizations and some municipal representatives. We are also graced with the presence of Mr. Martin, who helps us with technical questions and historical questions on the way statute has been drafted when we're looking at changes. Firefighters, investment brokers, and members of the public also attend the meetings to share their suggestions and experiences. Just for your information, all of the proposed changes in the working group bill have received unanimous consent from the working group members. And almost all changes in this bill are technical corrections or clarifications, so it's a great unsessioned bill. And so,
question just was, are there any we should be sure to think about that?
Madam Chair, would you like me to run through the sections very briefly? Or would you just want to pass the bill and we'll just...
I think we could actually ask...
I don't know, I'm just asking for brevity's sake.
Nice try. is this just the summary of the provisions? Why don't we just let Mr. Martin just give us the summary of the provisions that's on the first page?
Sure.
Okay, members, this bill is largely technical. There are very few policy issues. It does exclude some PERA, police and fire, covered municipalities from a fire state aid filing, which really was intended to apply to municipalities with no volunteer fire pension fund, where the fire state aid would be used for fire equipment or fire structure questions, and PERA police and fire plans don't seem to fit well. It does clarify a 5% limit on junk bonds. This is only relevant if the House still has its historic concern about volunteer firefighters and junk bonds, which you did about 10 or 15 years ago.
Mr. Martin, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Since I wasn't here 15 years ago, so for the sake of bringing me up to date, so what has been, if there's a limit, has it been greater than that, less than that? What's the deal with
Members, the House didn't want volunteer fire pension plans involved in junk bonds. Over time, they have been allowed some amount of junk bonds. This is really clarifying that there's a 5% limit, because there's some potential that there might not be any limit, that folks might be reading it as if it had no limit.
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Mr. Martin, can you tell us where we're at in terms of total investment into junk bonds as far as a percent of these funds right now?
Representative Benson, I don't think I can. It may be the case that this person from the state auditor's pension division can.
Well, if they don't, Madam Chair.
Yes.
If they don't testify, I would like to find out so that they could send an email. I guess what I'd be interested in is, well, does the fire pension fund now have to sell those off? Does that money need to be reinvested?
Madam Chair, members, Rose Hennessy Allen, pension director at the Office of the State Auditor. So the limit, they are limited to no more than 5% of their portfolios in junk bonds. And the change in this bill doesn't change the limit. It just clarifies that it applies to both domestic and international junk bonds. We generally don't see any issues with relief associations bumping up against that threshold.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Martin.
Members, the next item has to do with some provisions that are in current law that are highly repetitious, having to do with the applicable date that specifies eligibility for benefits, and those are in large measure aggregated together. And the application of them is expanded to include ancillary benefits. This is death or disability benefits, not just service pensions. So it's a tidying up provision. The defined contribution relief associations, there's a clarification with respect to the disposition of amounts that have been forfeited. Defined contribution plans have a vesting period. Individuals who don't render sufficient service to vest will ultimately forfeit the money that is in their account, and this handles that. With respect to, again, defined contribution plans and inactive former members, this clarifies their eligibility for ancillary benefits. So if a former inactive former member were to predecease their spouse, it would permit, in that case, a survivor benefit to the spouse if the bylaws so provide. Seven has to do with the entity that's responsible for ratifying plan amendments, and this clarifies that in the case of independent nonprofit firefighting corporations, they're the entity that's responsible for coming up with the funding for the pension plan, and they are now the entity responsible for ratifying plan amendments. Another nonprofit firefighting corporation issue is an item eight, and this has to do with when a benefit increase is in play. With whom does the filing of the actuarial work, well, not actuarial work, but the funding condition and funding cost determinations, and that would be with the Nonprofit Corporation Board. And then the last item has to do with the supplemental lump sum benefit that's payable to offset some tax issues from years ago, and this defines regular lump sum distribution in a manner that makes it easier for the Department of Revenue, which largely runs this program, to handle it.
Are there any questions? Then, Senator Johnson, you had an amendment?
Yes, I have the 5A amendment.
Are you aware that there's an amendment?
Yes. And I would ask if Fire Chief Zickman could come forward and
Chief Sickman?
Anyone?
The nonprofit.
I need to see one more.
Which amendment? Do you want him to explain it?
Members, I'll just make one brief comment. We have this issue comes up in part an item number 6 on our agenda, and so the amendment is actually drawn to that bill, but it's a freestanding section, so you can deal with the issue now or later. But that's why it's drawn to a different bill.
So, Madam Chair, I think then we might wait for that.
Yeah. Well, we can just take that.
This is a quorum. You may as well go ahead.
Yeah, okay, that's a good idea. Okay. Let's go ahead with it.
Go ahead.
Mr. Zickman, why do you need this amendment?
Madam Chair, forgive me, I think there's a little confusion. We just thought this was going to be on your and Atkins' bill.
That's fine. Yeah.
You want to hear it now?
Yeah, we can hear it now, as long as you're here and we have a quorum. Go ahead.
So, Madam Chair, members, last year an effort was put forth by a group of public safety professionals to do additional pension aids for police and fire. The fire aid portion was distributed with the 2% allocation, and when that was distributed last late summer, it became clear that the Department of Revenue took what we thought was an adverse ruling and had omitted the 61 nonprofit firefighting corporations in the state of Minnesota, which have always shared in the aid. I'm the chief of one of those. We have 6 chiefs of more of them in the metro area. As a rule, all of us contract with municipalities. We're protecting municipalities. We organized under state law. And so this amendment corrects that to make sure revenue is clear that, you know, we should be included in the additional aid distribution, just like we're included in the 2% aid distribution. There's no opposition to this. The fire service groups agree. It's the fairness equity issue. And I guess I would close there and stand for questions. Hey,
Mr. Zickman, it is clear to me that this needs to be in the context of the other bill number 6 on the agenda. I'm confused myself. Let's go back and let's decide on the state auditor's bill number 7. If we have any other
motion.
Did Senator Johnson, did you move that amendment?
It's okay.
I don't think she moved.
I don't think she moved.
Yeah, she didn't.
She did.
Okay. So if we don't have, does anyone else want to testify on Senate Bill 2429 or have any questions for the state auditor? All right, then let's have a motion. We want to incorporate
Chair.
It. Representative Murphy moves that Senate Bill 2429, House Bill 2218 amendments be recommended to be incorporated into the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, so as long as we're on the firefighter issue, then let's go back to number 6 on the agenda, which we started talking about the amendment. But let's talk about the base bill. Is this Mr. Martin?
Yes. Members, Mr. Zickman started to explain to some extent what is in play in Senate File 1951. 2013, a special supplemental aid program was established for a number of police and fire pension plans. You may remember the money that goes to the state patrol plan, to the PRA police and fire plan, and then about a third of the money goes to the volunteer fire departments. Because the legislation specifies, if you look on page 17 of the packet, look at the actual bill, line on page 1 of the bill, page 17 of your packets, on line 12, it references municipalities in this distribution to the volunteer fire. And what happened is that the independent nonprofit firefighting corporations, of which there are in the neighborhood of 36 or so, apparently, did not receive their portion of the supplemental aid. Mr. Zickman comes from the largest, I believe, of the independent nonprofit firefighting corporations, the Blaine Moundsview Spring Lake Park Fire Department. There are other large nonprofit firefighting corporations, Lake Johanna, for instance, in Ramsey County is a nonprofit firefighting corporation. There are quite a number of them in St. Louis County. So what this bill does, as drafted, it has the term, it defines municipality to include independent nonprofit firefighting corporations on page 2 of the bill. And that's one approach to resolving the problem. At this point, you may want to have Mr. Zickman or Mr. Rice present.
Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice, representing the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association. Mr. Martin laid this issue up. If you recall, a year ago we were working on to fund the PRA Police and Fire plan, and initially Senator Pappas, you had a bill, and Representative Atkins had, which would have done a surcharge on homeowner insurance and car insurance to come up with the money to fund that and help work that package out. That eventually came out of this committee as a separate bill and traveled on its own, and you, Senator Pappas, went through the Commerce Committee, it went to the Tax Committee. Ultimately, it was included in the tax bill. And in the drafting of this legislation, it kind of occurred outside of the Pension Commission purview, and what they did is they used the word municipalities, and the Revenue Department has taken the term municipalities quite literally and not included the nonprofit, independent nonprofit firefighting corporations. It was certainly always the intent when we presented the bill to the Pension Commission to include in the volunteer group of that aid, which is about $5.5 million, not only the fire departments associated with the municipality, but also these independent nonprofit firefighting corporations. That was always our intent. They were in all the runs that were done. I guess it's on me, Madam Chair, as a person who's lobbying the bill. We just lost it. But when it got into the tax committee, it was pretty opaque to try to get through to those people in terms of understanding our small issue in the scheme of big things. And, you know, I messed up, I guess, is probably the simple way of saying it. And we're here to ask the Pension Commission to correct that and fix the problem. And so that's the base issue to add the independent nonprofit matters. Mr. Zickman has a separate amendment that goes, so last year when they distributed the aid, these 61 independent nonprofit firefighting corporations didn't get their aid, which meant the other 650 or so volunteer fire departments got more aid, because that's kind of the issue that Mr. Zickman wants you to deal with. We can fix the problem going forward, but they would mean all these volunteer, or all these municipal relief associations got more aid than they anticipated last year, and the independent did not get the aid they expected.
So do they have to give it back?
Well, they wouldn't have to give it back. I think what Mr. Zickman is, the amendment that's proposed by Senator Johnson would be to basically in this year's allocation give the independent nonprofit firefighting corporations the aid they would get this year plus the aid they would have gotten last year, which means the other cities would get slightly less. And then going into 2015, everyone would get their proportional amount.
Okay. Is everybody on board with that? Mr.
Zickman. Madam Chair, Niall Zickman, representing Minnesota Fire Chiefs on this. And, yes, there's no opposition to this. We always look at it as a fairness issue. I do have, it's my own math. I took the 2012 aid times the distribution number and did the spreadsheet, if you want to pass them to commission members. We're talking about $243,000 out of $5.5 million. And, again, we make the one-time correction, and then we move forward.
It would be about 4% of the current aid would be, everyone would, from the amounts last year, would probably get 4% less than they got last year. The independent nonprofit would get, you know, their money this year, but then going forward, they'd all get the same.
Any questions? Anybody from the audience want to testify? And Senator Johnson moves the 5A amendment.
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Any questions on the base bill? Then
I would move.
Senator Johnson moves that Senate Bill 1951, House Bill 2427, as amended. be recommended to pass and incorporated into the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right,
thank you, Madam Chair, and members.
Welcome. No, don't mess up again, Mr. Rice.
Don't count on it.
Not too many people come before the Pension Commission and admit that they couldn't get something through the Tax Committee. It's not an easy committee.
Right.
Five, I think, is connected with that same provision.
All right, let's take up number five, because there's Mr. Martin tells me there's a connection here with what we just did.
Members, item number five is really a correction of errors that we've flagged, and it relates to the same provisions that you were just looking at, or at least it includes that. There are three corrections that are being made here. If you turn to page three of the memo, which is the first page of the bill, and look on line 24, we had a bad cross-reference on line 24. We had a cross-reference to subdivision 1A of a particular statute, and the operative statute provision that we really needed was subdivision 1. So that gets cleaned up. Revenue did do this one correctly upon receipt of a letter from the joint leadership, because the alternative would have been that the minimum fire state aid for the smaller volunteer fire plans would not have been paid last year. So that's why it's made retroactive, is to back up the fact that revenue did it as intended rather than as drafted. Section 2 of the bill on page 2, we have percentages. This is the provision that you just looked at with respect to Senator Johnson's bill. The problem here is if you add up the three percentages, you get to 100.01% of the aid rather than 100% of the aid. And so we are correcting it so it adds to 100%. And then the third item in Section 3, this would be on page 3 of the bill. At one point, the supplemental aid that you processed last year in 2013 was going to be distributed to some additional entities. It was going to offset some of the contribution rate increases by cities and by counties. So it was going to the PERA police and fire employing units. And to do that in a logical way, we needed to have a way of divvying up that portion of the pot. And it was going to be done based on the number of firefighters and the number of police officers. Well, that part of the law, that part of the bill never became law. So having this designation of police officers and firefighters no longer is necessary. And so as part of the uncession, we can remove a provision that no longer has any application, although it was just passed last year.
Our contribution to the uncession. Any questions? Anyone from the audience? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 2597 be included in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Very
strong aye on that one.
That will be done by 6:30.
Why don't we go now to number three? Representative Hayden and Senator Hayden, Representative Khan, and Mr. Burke, you want to tell us briefly what this one's about?
The bill is the last page of the packet, it's 23, it's a one-page bill. And as drafted, what this bill would do is it would take anyone who was a member of local relief associations that consolidated into para or para police fire prior to some of the more recent consolidations. This doesn't include, for instance, the Minneapolis. But it would take any individuals who were in these local plans that consolidated into para or police and fire, and it would increase the benefits for service retirees and disabilities. There would be increased by 20% or up to $38,000, whichever is less. And survivors would receive an adjustment of a 20% increase or a benefit of $30,000, whichever is less. There are some considerable problems with the bill. As drafted, it really amounts to plan swapping. Individuals retired under local benefit plans, and what the bill in effect does is create a benefit for these individuals that approximates the benefits that they would have gotten under parapolice and fire in a fairly rough form. That is something that commission members may be somewhat concerned about, because it could create an argument, for instance, for IRAP members who freely chose to be covered by the IRAP plan to come in later and say, well, that didn't work out particularly well for me. I would prefer a TRA benefit instead, because what's happening here, frankly, is quite similar. Another issue is the whether it's appropriate to overturn what were presumed to be irrevocable elections. Anyone who was an active member in the local relief associations at the time of consolidation was able to choose whether they wanted local plan benefits in their entirety or parapolice fire benefits in their entirety. And anyone else, anyone who was already retired at the time of the consolidation, got to choose whether they wanted post-retirement adjustments under the local plan benefits or whether they would get post-retirements under the parapolice fire plan. So to the extent that some individuals definitely chose the local plan benefit in its entirety, and to the extent that any member of that group decided it wanted to stay with local plan post-retirement adjustments, to the extent that that's causing a problem, those outcomes were the result of decisions made by the individuals. It was made by elections that they made. Another issue is windfall problems. I'll mention one. There may be some others, but active members at the time of retirement, I've mentioned that they got to choose whether they wanted the local plan in its entirety or parapolice and fire in its entirety. Well, some of those individuals chose the local plan in its entirety for very logical reasons. It provided those individuals with a higher benefit. And the reason it did was because in local plans, you could retire earlier than you could in parapolice and fire with full benefits. And the local plans typically provided some survivor coverage without any reduction in the benefit to the individual. So there were cases where the individuals looked at the benefits that would be provided under two plans. The local plan was better, so that's what they chose. But under this bill, these individuals would now get the benefits increased to be more like what would be provided in parapolice and fire. What happened with those individuals over time is the post-retirement adjustments in the local plan and the parapolice and fire plan were not the same, and they crossed over. And so that at this point in time, many years later, the benefits are higher under parapolice and fire, and this would sort of allow these individuals to get the best of both worlds, making the decision that was best for them at the time of retirement and now getting this windfall of additional amounts by this adjustment.
Okay. Why don't we hear from Mr. Rice and Ms. Vanek then?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice. I'm appearing tonight not representing any active client. At one point in my career, I represented a number of these former relief associations. There were by 2000, there were 44 of them that had consolidated with PARA, and since then, in just the last 2 years, four others have. And over the years, I'd heard from former clients that things hadn't worked out as they thought, or were wondering why there were differences in pensions. And I think, as Mr. Burke pointed out, people make choices all the time, and paths diverge, and it's just, you just have to deal with that. People make the best decisions they can at the time. And this bill was introduced at the end of last session. And maybe to give just one example, I knew a fellow named John Mercado quite well. He's a St. Paul police officer, lived on the west side. Perhaps you knew him, Senator Pappas, longtime member of the department. John recently died. At the time of his death, he was making about $5,000 a month in pensions, which was a very good pension, no doubt about that. But his when John died, his spouse's pension dropped to $1,800. Mrs. Mercado is about my mother's age in her late 80s, didn't work, didn't have Social Security through her regular employment stuff, and really is quite dependent on that pension. And that there are some unique circumstances there about when John retired, and when he retired, he had the option to, Ms. Vanna could explain this better than I, but had the option to take PRA escalation, which he did, which was the right decision. But now that he's died, they're going back and calculating her benefit under the old bylaws or laws governing the St. Paul Police Department, which ties the benefit to what would be the base pay of a patrol officer currently, and that accounts for a major drop. Ordinarily, a surviving spouse of a police officer would have an option was chosen, would be, it was an automatic 50% annuity, and if that was the case, then PRA Mrs. Mercado's pension would have been more like $2,500 a month instead of $18. And there, it appears that, the group that we're talking about are surviving or service pensioners in their mid-70s and surviving spouses on average in their mid-80s. So it's a much older cohort, and I think I'll let Ms. Vanek talk about some of the numbers she has, but you'll see that this group's average benefits are quite a bit lower than the average benefits of PRA. And I appreciate, and some of these members, Ms. Vanek has done a lot of work in the last week or so to give the commission some numbers about how big this issue may be. And I just felt that in the interest of some of these people I used to represent, it's a matter that the Pension Commission may want to take a look at. I know it's very complicated. It may not be in this session that this issue can get resolved, but I do think there's an equity issue out there for a number of these, particularly the surviving spouses of these members, an anomaly of the statute. A lot of things have happened, and many people probably made the right choice. Some people, and probably particularly these women who didn't have much of a choice, are in. That's a pretty big drop from $5,000 a month in income to $1,800.
Let's hear from Ms. Vanek briefly, and then I'd like to lay this bill aside and take up number four before we lose a quorum here. So Ms. Vanek.
Okay, Madam Chair. Quickly, I met with Representative Kahn and Mr. Rice yesterday. Mary Vanek, Director of PARA, for the record. We met yesterday because we have many questions about who this was supposed to include. And so after our discussion yesterday, we took out some folks. We took out deferred members who had less than 20 years of service because they didn't, you know, that wasn't a career. We actually found a couple of them had MSRS coverage for other work, so they really have other income. So we excluded them. There were 6 to 8 of those. And then we did find a number of surviving spouses. You saw in the memo that we came up with like almost 800 people. Well, we did a major data scrub in the last 2 days and took out a number of surviving spouses that were listed whose benefits are below these levels, but their members actually, their member spouses actually took para, police, and fire benefits, and they took a lower joint and survivor option. So what they're receiving isn't up to what this bill provides, but they did choose para, police, and fire benefits. So we didn't include those. There aren't any disability benefit recipients that are included in this. The four that we have on record all took para, police, and fire benefits. So what we ended up with, we think this is accurate. We're still doing data scrubbing. We ended up with about 346 benefit recipients, 58 retirees, and 288 survivors. And these surviving spouses are, as Mr. Rice described, they are tied to the old Relief Association bylaw calculation, which is much lower than what would have been provided through some percentage of the police and fire benefit or the benefit that the individual was receiving at death. What we did see is that the average police and fire benefit currently in para, police, and fire is an annual benefit of $50,792. The average benefit for this group of 58 individuals is $30,540, and even with this adjustment would bring them up to $33,784 annually. For the survivors, the annual benefit or average benefit for para is $28,584. For this group of 288, that average benefit currently is $21,789, and this adjustment would bring them up to $25,187. The cost, now this is unaudited. We haven't run it by our actuary. We did it ourselves as staff. We put in the present value factors and came up with an unaudited estimate of $7.7 million in present value to cover the cost of increasing these benefits for these individuals. The board's position is this must be funded. So, and I would like to work with Mr. Rice and staff. If we're going to advance this, we'd like to tighten up the criteria, and we'd like to at least have until October 1st to make the adjustments, because it's running up against our Duluth solution we hope to get done this year in more police and fire benefit retirements, and we just need a little more time if this does pass.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Vanek, is this a one-time $7.7 million cost, or is this an ongoing $7.7 million cost?
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, that is the actuarial present value cost to increase these benefits for their expected lifetime, one time.
Not yearly. Okay, we're going to lay that bill over then. I'm sorry, Representative
Chair, just from the standpoint, however, you know, this would satisfy this one, but in previous testimony, we heard that this, in effect, what it does, and we should have some concern, is allow for people later on, you know, in their receiving their benefits, to look over the fence and say, but I like this other one better. I mean, that's what we heard. So I think we need to take this seriously. In that, are we opening ourselves up for people later on in similar situations who haven't paid into the system to make a decision about, I like what the other guy's got? And I think we need to proceed very cautiously. I would hope that this would, in fact, extend till next year so that we could really get some implications of what this might mean.
Madam Chair, just a quick point on that. I think it's a fair question. One part of the history I didn't mention, in 1999, when they consolidated these 44 and put them into PARA, times were great. There was excess money, and the Pension Commission approved a bill that returned $58 million on a one-time basis to all these cities because everything was great. And that $58 million came from these men, you know, be like my dad now, and he's dead 17 years now, in their 80s, and their wives that are in their 90s. And it's an equity issue. It's a fair question, Representative Benson, but the other part of the story is at one point all these cities and all these members returned $58 million in 1999 to these cities. So it's an equity question. I do think it's probably a matter that's going to take a lot of thought and for consideration.
Madam Chair, just real quick to follow up, that this is another Brian, maybe another Mr. Rice mistake, though, that we really need to make sure.
The $58 million that was given back?
Well, no, just the fact that we're painting a picture of there's an equity issue, and in fact, these people chose these plans because it was good. And now when it's not quite so good, they're looking over their, you know, and I get it. But the fact is we're opening ourselves up to even potentially down the road more folks coming to this commission asking for the same kind of treatment. That's my concern.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, just for the record, the 288 survivors really had no choice. The consolidation law said that if their member spouse was already retired at the time that they consolidated, when it came time to give them a survivor benefit, it had to be based on the Relief Association bylaws. That was something negotiated in the consolidation laws that were enacted in 1987. So I just want it clear that they didn't really make a choice. The law dictated that that's what they had to receive. And so some of them, their spouses lived a long time, and those post-retirement adjustments through PARA really put them out of proportion to what the widowers were going to end up getting. But I just want to clarify that that is a requirement of law.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, and it's pinging off a little bit what Representative Benson said. Ms. Vanek, do you see any other negotiated mergers or things that we might be seeing on the horizon, or is this wholly, solely, exclusively the one?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think you've consolidated everybody you possibly could into PDR. I think we're done.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we're going to lay that over, and then let's go to number four. I think this should be very quick. Mr. Martin.
Members, this is a correction or a picking up of cross-references based on something that was done in 2013, so I think it's fairly technical. With the consolidation of the Minneapolis Police and the Minneapolis Fire plans into PERA, there were provisions in that 2011 law that handled post-retirement increases for both plans. In 2013, you modified the PERA Police and Fire post-retirement adjustment provisions, which were the law that was cited for the two Minneapolis consolidations and their future post-retirement increases. But we didn't add the appropriate references to the revisions to the PERA Police and Fire post-retirement adjustment that were made in 2013 as part of the 2013 law. So what the bill does is adds those cross-references.
Okay, Senator Hayden or Representative Kahn, you want to move this bill?
I'd like to move.
Representative Kahn moves that.
Part of the omnibus bill.
Senate File 2532, House File 2554 be recommended to be included in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
This is the simplest thing I've had to do.
You did a great job with it, too.
Okay, all week.
Members, we have actually only one more bill on our agenda, and that's number 8, Senate File 2308 and House File 2604. And I'm not sure this bill was being negotiated, and I'm not sure if it's ready to go. Senator Johnson, did you want to have the bill tonight, or would you rather carry it over till next week?
Representative Murphy, what do you think? We have been negotiating on this bill for a bit.
But it's not ready for prime time, but I don't know if it's going to be any better next week.
Do you want to start with some testimony?
I think it would be good to have the presentation of the bill.
Presentation of the bill.
And so we can hear it one more time and the various Mr. Martin's
interpretations. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will have to be leaving shortly as well to join some of the other House members in committee this evening, so if that helps you with your decision about how you want to move this or lay it over for next week, since we are losing House members rather rapidly on our side here.
And we wouldn't vote tonight, but if we think we need to have more House members hear the presentation, maybe we should wait. Do you know how many bills we have next week?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Senator Johnson.
You know, Representative Murphy, you could inform the House members that weren't able to stay.
Our people are here.
The people are here. There are people here to testify. So and I kind of like the idea of having it brought up today and then doing some action next week.
So why don't we have people testify tonight, and then we could have Mr. Martin kind of sum up and give us the staff's perspective next week. Does that work?
Sure.
Okay. Who would like to come forward on Senate File 2308, House File 2604, and provide us with some background or testimony? Who is here to do that?
This is really useful.
Welcome to the commission. Could you just state your name for the tape?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, I'm here in support of this bill. This was a governor's recommendation moved from the Department of Human Services through Department of Management, Minnesota Management and Budget, to be part of the governor's policy agenda for this upcoming session. Just to familiarize you with the parts of the bill, there are really three parts to this bill. One would, and it has to do with the Correctional Employee Retirement Program. Right now, it was unclear the definition of the Minnesota Security Hospital in statute. We were very concerned in the department that we would have to remove some of the employees who work in that program from the correctional and retirement and program, so have put forward language that would make clear that the definition of the Minnesota Security Hospital incorporates all of the programs of the Minnesota Security Hospital, serving clients who've been committed to the commissioner as mentally ill and dangerous. So that's one piece of the legislation. The next piece of the legislation would take care of a rather complicated situation that we have with a program that was called the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program, known as METO. We completed a court settlement for that program about 2 years ago, and as a part of that court settlement, agreed to close that program. At one time, there were up to 60 clients there with developmental disabilities, mental health issues, and a very aggressive behavior. At that time, that the METO program was also by statute in the CERP program. But because of the closing of that program, there was some confusion about what to do with those staff. So as we've added staff to that program, we have not put them on the correctional retirement program, but that left in place some staff who were on the program. So again, like the definition of the security hospital, we're trying to clean up what we see as a problem inside the agency by at the same time not disrupting the status that some staff have in the correctional retirement employee retirement program. The third part of this proposal then would add a new group. It is the clinical therapist. We refer to them as CPT-2s. They are used in the sex offender treatment program. We hadn't used this classification for a period of time. We are now planning to use that classification. They would be working side by side with others who are already in this retirement program. In all cases, I think it's important to understand that these are people who work in direct care programs, who have patient and client contact in our programs, in both the sex offender treatment program and in the security hospital. That's a very quick overview of the parts of the bill, what's been included in the governor's policy bill, and certainly able to stand for questions if you have them, Madam Chair and members.
Are there any questions for Ms. Berry?
Oh.
Senator Goodwin.
Ms. Berry, my understanding is that there aren't going to be any additional employees added to the correctional plan. Is that correct?
Madam Chair? Madam Chair and Senator, we have this would now include all the staff who work on the St. Peter campus, both in the sex offender program and in security hospital. And so we would not be asking to add any more staff from our other programs to the correctional employee retirement program.
Mr. Bergstrom, does MSRS have a position
I'd like
on this?
To hear that.
Madam Chair, Dave Bergstrom, the director of the state retirement system. We're comfortable with the bill. The people that are included are already members of our plan, so for the most part, not adding anybody other than the CPT-2, and my understanding, they have people working out of class already covered by the plan. So it really doesn't change much from a membership standpoint. So it doesn't have any financial impact,
no financial impact
on MSRS.
Is there anyone else that wanted to testify? Okay, I know that the staff had some concerns about this provision, and there's been some discussions with the staff just because of some of the misunderstandings here. So, and we have lost our quorum. So let's take this bill up then again next week. And I know we're going to have trouble because it's another deadline week next week, and but I think we need to have some more discussions about this. As well as we don't have a quorum to pass it, to include it if we want to include it. So we'll lay this bill over till next week, and the meeting is adjourned. I suppose I could have let you speak on this right now.
Oh, there are three.
But what you want to do is some of the stuff to lay over here.